And good morning and welcome to Lambda Weekly. I'm David Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink, and our guest today is Justin Reed Early. He's the author of Street Child. Justin describes himself in the book, and I love this, Justin describes himself in his book as having more issues than People magazine. Justin, are you there?
I'm here. Good morning.
I love that description of you. You also have a master's degree in manipulation.
I do.
And congratulations. I don't know anybody else quite with that degree. But today we're going to talk about things that are near and dear to Patty's heart, homelessness, drug addiction, prostitution especially.
Yeah, those are on my...
Those are right on her bucket list of all the things she needs to do one of these days.
Hi, Patty.
Hi, Justin. How are you?
And we're joking about this, but this is a real serious book. Justin, just set up what the book is about.
Well, the book is about, I experienced homelessness at a very young age, as many young people do in America every year. Mainly, I came from a middle-class family, so, that's one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book. I mean, people experience homelessness for a lot of reasons, but, I was a middle-class, white, privileged child, what I mean? There was no reason for me to be homeless. Except for that, there were certain belief systems in place in my family that contributed to my demise as far as my family unit was concerned. So when my father suspected that I was gay, that was intolerable, and I would either get with the program or I would leave. And I had to leave because there was really no way for me to be anything other than who I was authentically.
And as much as we started off joking about this a little bit, it's a very serious topic, but you're okay now.
Oh yeah.
This happened when you were a teen, and you're now in your extremely late 20s.
Extremely late, yes. 20.
That's where I am too.
That's where Patty and I are.
I've been 29 for many, many years.
Exactly. So I just want to set that up, that we're not making fun of these things because we're really
no,
not. These are real serious issues. So how did you become homeless?
Well, I became homeless because my father, who was an alcoholic, became increasingly violent. Again, he had some belief systems that he was very that he affirmed that were very bigoted. And so, when it was clear that I was definitely the gay child, he definitely took issue with that. So there was a lot of conflict at home, and it became very uncomfortable for me. And not only was he physically abusive, he was verbally abusive. He was a bully. He was a family bully. So, when we hear about people talk about bullying in schools, well, that happens at home, too, with brothers and sisters and parents. So he was a bully, and I just knew that I deserved better. Mm-hmm. And I found better on the street, basically. And, it is a very serious issue, and I make light of a lot of it in the book, as you know, as I've read. So I appreciate that, and I respect that, because if I wasn't able to laugh up at some of the stuff, I wouldn't be alive today.
That's one of the things that I've found from talking to people who are formerly homeless, that they've either overcome it, become successful, or not talking to them afterwards, but hearing about them afterwards, they either end up successful or end up dead.
Yes.
And fortunately, you were able to overcome what happened to you. Now, did you leave your house voluntarily? Tell us how you ended up leaving your house.
It was one of those bullying moments where my father was trying to control me and be, he was very verbal, abusively. And I was just fed up, and I ran. I ran down. He had punched me in the face. I was 10 years old, and I was just fed up. I was done. I ran down to the police station, and I tried to have him arrested for domestic violence. And this is 1980. They didn't really do that yet. Like, there's been a lot of progress made as far as, domestic violence and, many issues that I talk about in the book since 1980. But, one of the things that the police did try to do is get me to go to my aunt's, who came down to the police station to pick me up. And when he found out that she was down there, he came down and said, absolutely not. Either you come home or you go to the state. So that's something that, that we talk about a lot when I do book signings and stuff, because, what what we try to do now is try to encourage family members and people involved in the village, you know, with healthy and productive lives, to participate and to help a child when there's that type of conflict at home.
Now,
that way the child doesn't end up on the streets.
Now, this was in Washington State that
correct.
This happened.
Yes, yeah.
It, you know, and it's interesting how, and I guess this has just evolved because this happened in the 1980s, but it's interesting how, while Texas has, let's see, we're last in education, last in health care, last in...
We say in Texas, thank God for Mississippi.
Well, yeah, except in a couple of those things, yeah, Mississippi's still ahead of us. But one thing...
Well, you know what that is. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, one thing that I think we do rank ahead of most other states has to do with our foster system.
Mm-hmm.
We don't screw around with it, and we don't allow parents to be abusing their kids, and when they are, they're taken out of their home, and unless the parent within 1 year can prove that things have been fixed, that kid is taken from that family and is on the way to adoption and is not just lost in a foster system somehow. And lots of kids in Texas get lost in the foster system because there are too damn many in the foster system. But some of the things that happen to you along the way, I would like to think, wouldn't have happened here because that's not how our system works. So it's kind of interesting hearing your experience of, like the aunt. Texas Child Protective Services would have said to the father, you don't have a right, and would have gotten a court order, this kid goes with his aunt.
Right. And that's important, and Texas is definitely ahead of the game than, you know, maybe a lot of other states. So, you know, that's something that we talk about.
In one area only.
In one area only.
Yeah.
Well, and it's so important to address that. Because,
it is important,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah, my life would have been a lot better if I was with my aunt, you know. And we're still in contact today. She's, you know, 80 years old, but, you know, she's still very loving. All her kids did very well in their lives, and she was an excellent role model and parental figure. So, you know, those are the things that we need to look at. But my father's ego would not allow him to have me go to her.
And I think that's really extraordinary that, I mean, there were a lot of kids out there whose families will reject them because they're LGBT. And and because they don't approve of it, they don't like it, they don't want to have anything to do with it, and they may not make their home welcoming and the kid will leave, or they'll kick them out. But to go to the extreme of going chasing you down and telling you can't live with your family, other family members, that's like wanting to make sure you are destroyed.
Exactly. You know? And, you know, I have this saying, you know, if you don't like the way that God created your child, you need to find another God. Because if you're walking around and you're treating your children like that, it's just not acceptable. And you know what? There will be a price to pay. If that's your belief system and you believe in the heaven and hell thing, you know what? You will be held accountable. Because these children are going and they're suffering horribly. They're sexually abused. They're physically abused. They're killed. They commit suicide. They get addicted on drugs. I mean, these issues are serious. When you kick a child out, you have no way of preventing them from going through this cycle of misery. It's just there. That's the way that it's set up. When they hit the street, somebody offers them a place to stay, more than likely they're going to want a little something for whatever they're getting, you know, or giving.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, they say that, you know, 40 to 80% of the children that hit the streets homeless are sexually abused.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers are staggering.
And you were 10 years old when this started.
Yeah.
So,
and I was arrested for prostitution at 11. Arrested and criminalized for being a prostitute at 11 years old. I was just trying to eat. I was just trying to get somewhere to stay. You know?
One of the things that you say in the book is that at one point, and you're a little bit older when you say this, that you were arrested at one point and you were almost proud of that because it added to that criminal record of yours.
It did.
And isn't that an interesting change of values? I mean, it just...
Yeah, like a badge of honor. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I wanted to punish my family. I wanted to punish my father. And I really felt like hurting myself would do that. And maybe it did in a way, but at the end of the day, I was hurting myself. And I think that, you know, a lot of people talk about this that are in recovery or that are, you know, going through different various issues in their lives. that, you know, sometimes we tend to be very hard on ourselves. And basically what I did is I got involved in a cycle that was really hurting me. You know.
But at 10 years old, you don't understand that.
Exactly. You don't. You
well,
don't.
The
extraordinary,
you really do. The extraordinary thing here to me is the contrast with what we think of as a normal, loving family in this country. You know, where parents are wringing their hands at the very thought that their child might go off to college and be away from it. Will they be able to survive? Will they be able to do their laundry? Will they keep up with their money? You know, all these things. And they're moving out into their own apartment. Oh, my gosh. And here, you know, that they're not competent yet to do that. And yet some people would be willing to kick a little kid out and expect them to, I guess, maybe not expect them to survive.
Yeah.
I mean, because if they're not capable at 20, they're not capable at 10.
They're surely not. And that's one of the things that we were talking about yesterday. We're filming a Kickstarter video so I can, you know, fund a national book tour to various youth homeless shelters in the United States. And we were talking about some of the things that we want to change. And, you know, Hillary Clinton got a lot of heat for saying that it takes a village to raise a child.
Right.
And it does take a village to raise a child because, you know, some people are sitting at home burning the village down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to step in and we have to make sure that, you know, this is America. We're the richest country in the world. We need to make sure that our children are fed and we need to make sure that they're safe. We also need to make sure that they're educated and that they have equal opportunities, no matter what race they are, no matter what how they identify. It's just, you know, and these are the things that we're working towards, and we've done a really great job. And I know you guys have been on the air for many, many years, and you've contributed to that success, but we're not there yet.
Sure. I want to go back to when you were kicked out of your house. You were kicked out of your house. Your father wouldn't let your aunt take you in. Is there a shelter for kids?
Well, what happened back in those times, there was a, and I think it still exists now, there was a place called the Department of Social and Health Services that provided receiving homes, families who got paid to take children temporarily, whether it was for a couple days or for a few weeks. And I started going to receiving homes, and that's how I met a child who had been on the streets. And it was just a very unloving, uncomfortable environment for me to be in. I mean, these were families that were clearly not in the game to help people. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I found solace on the street.
Well,
once I produced them.
Yeah, and a friend of mine who was in that situation when he was a kid, he called those kinds of homes that actually took in foster kids for the money. Kind of like Michelle Bachmann's home where she had 18 foster kids and you're paid per foster kid. He calls those puppy mills.
And they pretty much are.
And he means it just that way, that the family that he was placed with that had him there for the money, when they went on vacation, they would put him in a separate home and take the other kids with him. That when they were having steak for dinner, he'd get a hamburger. I mean, he felt like he was the dog in the family.
You know what? We used to have to eat downstairs. We were locked in the basement. The family would eat upstairs at mealtime, and then we would be fed downstairs. And they'd lock the door in between the two rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean that, and it still goes on today. I mean, there, you know, again, we've made great advances in foster care, and I think a lot of more. And now that you know, LGBT community are fostering children. I think that we've made great strides, you know, because people are really doing it because they want to do it, they want to help, and they want to be of service, and that's what we need.
Well, and here in Texas, again, to tout our foster system, we get calls regularly, can you help promote that we're looking for more foster families, and we need gay and lesbian foster families, first of all, because of the shortage of foster families, but second of all, because you guys make good foster parents. You know, you understand kids being thrown out of houses and what they could possibly need.
Exactly. And you know what? Let me tell you, I'm still, you know, I'm on this journey and I'm growing and I'm learning and I'm perfecting my life. And, you know, I've been in a relationship and, you know, do I feel right now today that I'm ready to be a foster parent? No, I'm not there yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I know I have to also make a very conscious decision. Do I want to help? Yeah, I do. But I got to go in the direction where it's going to be most beneficial for not only our community, but for the world. And right now, like, being a foster parent would not be a responsible decision for me to do. You know, so just admitting what we can do. You know, I think a lot of people want to help, and sometimes they can be a little over zealous when it comes to that. But just really be really clear about what you do, and, you know.
Right. We are talking to Justin Reed Early. His book is Street Child. Where can people get the book?
The best deal on the book is Amazon.com. You can also go to my website, which is streetchildmemoir.com. And if you just click on the book, comes up when you hit the website, it'll take you straight to Amazon. It's on sale right now for $8.85, which is really, really a good price.
It's a great price.
Is it as an e-book, too?
Is what?
Is it available as an electronic book?
It is. It's on Kindle as well for $5.99.
Great. Okay. Justin, stick with us. We need to take a break. We're going to be back more with Justin Reed Early. His book is Street Child. And we'll be back with more right after this.
Great.
Canon thanks you for your pledge to our recent pledge drive. Now is the time to make your pledge count. Send your pledge to KNON's P.O. Box 710909, Dallas, Texas 75371. If you missed our pledge drive, you can still support community radio by pledging on the web at KNON.org. Your pledge only counts if you pay it. That's KNON Box 710909, Dallas, Texas 75371. Be sure you put the name of the show you are supporting on the check, money order, or the envelope. Questions about KNON Pledge Drive, call 214-828-9500, extension 234.
When they're gone for good. This is Scott from KNON's Texas Blues Radio telling you don't miss out on some great blues. KNON's Texas Blues Radio Volume 5 Blues CD. It's a CD put together by real blues fans for real blues fans like you. Texas Blues Radio Volume 5 features great local blues from Michael J. and the Paul Bird Band, J.J. and the Detonators, the Chris Watson Band, the Two Tones, Rough Cut Blues Band, Jeff Stone with Charlie Love, Dave Millsap, Sirloin and the Ass-Kicking Machine, Tutu Jones, Blues Boy Bo, Buddy Whittington, Andrea Dawson, Kirkland James, Sonny Colley, and Johnny Red and the Roosters. Get a copy now at Forever Young Records in Grand Prairie, Recordtown in Fort Worth, and in Dallas at Bill's Records. This is a Dallas Blues collector's item. A very limited amount of vinyl copies can be found at Forever Young Records, the sponsor of this great blues project. CD downloads are available at cdbaby.com. Whether you get it as a download, on vinyl, or on CD, all the proceeds will benefit KNON. For more info on Texas Blues Radio Volume 5, visit KNON.org.
I'm Michael from UNT, and I listen to Lambda Weekly on KNON 89.3 FM.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm David Taffet, here with the drug-addicted Patty Fink. And our guest today is Justin Reed Early. His book is Street Child. Somebody called in during the break, wanted to make sure I mentioned it again. Name of the book is Street Child. You can get it on Amazon, can get it on Kindle. Justin, I just want to tell you one funny thing. I've known Kathy Renna, who's you're a publicist, and that's how we hooked up. Known Kathy for probably almost 20 years. She is the only person to have ever crashed our show.
She's awesome.
She was here in Dallas. You were here when she crashed. Yeah, okay.
We were at the old crack house.
We were at the old crack house, which is the name of our old studio. And, we always schedule our guests, just like you and I scheduled that you'd be on. Kathy was here in Dallas. She was with a friend.
By.
And she just dropped by, and we didn't have a guest that day, so she just went on the air with the only person in our 30-year history.
Yeah. She has been doing what she does passionately for many, many years.
She has.
And she's really good at it. And she's not just a publicist. She is an advocate, and she is an instrumental figure for not only LGBT issues, but for homeless youth issues and every issue that you can imagine that benefits the planet.
Right.
And we love Kathy.
I just thought you'd enjoy knowing that about her, though. Because whenever I think of Kathy, I think of her just, hey, you know, just walking into the studio in the middle of a show. Anyway, Justin Reed Early is our author. His book is Street Child. He was homeless at the age of 10. How did you get into drug addiction again?
Well, you know, when you get to the streets, you know, we talked about like the cycle of, you know, that whole process. You know, once you get into that lifestyle, once you hit Skid Row, once you get involved, you know, that's the way of life, you know, and you just begin to participate in and to do, when in Rome, you do what the Romans do. Mm-hmm. You know, you do whatever you can to survive.
So the other older kids that you met were doing drugs, so you did too.
Exactly. That's the information that was passed down. Our new role models were drug addicts and pimps and prostitutes and criminals. And, you know, those are the people that were teaching us how to survive.
Well, and how do you survive doing drugs like that? You know, what did you eat? When did you eat? Could you eat?
Well, I didn't really, you know, I think for me, like, I started doing drugs at a very, very young age because everybody else was doing it. But then once I started doing them, I realized that they became a solution for me. Like, people talk about having a drug problem. Drugs were my solution. I wouldn't have been able to go through what I went through without having them there. Now, they definitely devastated my life at a very young age, and I was able to get out of it, thank God. But, you know, for that period of time while I was on the streets living this horrible life, they weren't a solution, and they medicated me, and they silenced a lot of the feelings that I had going through that experience.
Mm-hmm. So at 10, you're thrown out of the out of your house. You had been going to school. All of a sudden, no school.
All of a sudden, no school.
But yeah. You have more than a third grade education.
I do. You know, when I was a kid, you got locked up for being a runaway. They put a warrant out for your arrest, and you were criminalized mm-hmm. for having a horrible family. I mean, mm-hmm. basically, you were punished for that. So I would be locked up pretty regularly for short periods of time. And during those periods of time, one of the ways to get out of your cell was to go to school. And so I did participate in, you know, very small intervals of school, but I also was able to go back to school and did some college in the 90s once I went through Waldman House. When I was 20, I think 21, I got my GED, and then I went to college and participated in some other training and stuff. So, you know, I did have an opportunity to go back to school.
When you were kicked out and you were like seeking services and seeking help on the street and all of these experiences, was it in the same community where your family lived, or did you leave the city or leave that community and go somewhere else to?
That's a good question, because my family was more in the suburbs of Seattle, and the street activity was in downtown Seattle, right in the downtown. And if you ever saw the movie Streetwise, which I was in with a lot of my friends, it documents, like, where the locations were. And it was right down in the streets where all the, you know, the XXX shops were, and, mm-hmm. you know, all that kind of stuff, the nightlife. And so that's where that community was located. So, yeah, I was definitely away from my family.
Okay, yeah, and Seattle, it's not just, like, flat grid like Dallas is
right.
That just goes on till you get to Oklahoma. So, I mean, there's water in the way. So,
it
really
and topography.
Is and topography, right. We're not used to that. We have to think of those things that we have to realize.
I went to Dallas last year. I loved it. I enjoy Dallas very much.
Well, if you're here again, you'll come in the studio and join us again talking about these things. So you fell into drug addiction. You fell into prostitution.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How did that happen? And I understand from watching other kids doing it, and I guess it was the way that you got some money.
Well, it was. And, you know, I talk about it in my book, too. You know, I met a man. He was a preacher on the street, and he was a closeted pedophile. Mm-hmm. And I say that because, you know, I don't really believe pedophiles are gay or straight. You know, once you cross that line and that's your thing, you're not. I don't really identify you as gay or straight or
sure.
anything like that. And I found, you know, I think that thankfully the information that has been passed on by mostly the religious right has tried to, you know, wrap us up into that, you know, identification. But what I found and my experience was that, you know, this is a man who had serious mental issues and a disorder.
And he was married, wasn't he?
He was married,
yeah.
And he liked little boys and little girls.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he was a predator, and he groomed me, and I think for many years I thought he was a good man.
Well, because he was giving you things that nobody else did, like
food. Yes, he was, and... like food and like drugs. Like, he was really where the drug addiction became a serious problem at a very, very young age.
That's amazing that he would enable that. Yeah. You know what I mean? And, yeah. and given the context of everything, that I'm going to help you by giving you drugs.
Right, you know, exactly.
Kid. And he's a minister.
Well, he was a very sick man. Very sick man.
Well,
very
he called man. Himself a minister. I mean, he wasn't.
Yeah, that doesn't necessarily mean he is.
Yeah, and I don't want a group. I don't want a group. You know, I have a lot of really good friends who are Christians and who are very, you know, progressive as the beliefs that hurt people, and they shy away from that. And I love them, and I think they're great. And I don't want to just compartmentalize every Christian and say that they're bad people. Because
of course not. Yeah, of course not. But so. He brought you into his house.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any sort of a normal life while you were living with him?
A little bit, but, you know, the drugs were a big factor in my lifestyle with him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there were moments where, you know, I would try to go to school, and I talk a little bit about it in the book. I just didn't feel like I fit in. I mean, there was something really bad going on at home, and I knew it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a secret, and it was something that I couldn't share with anybody, and it was scary. And, you know, it was just this time period in my life where I was very alone, but this man was giving me attention, and he was feeding me, whether it was food or whether it was drugs. And I think I felt sort of safe with him,
mm-hmm.
but it definitely isolated me from the rest of the world.
Were there other kids in the house at the time?
There was a couple kids that came in and out, kids that I knew from the streets who needed a place to stay or that he was involved in, yeah.
Huh. Had he ever been arrested before?
He got arrested while I was living with him.
But had never been before? He had no record?
I think he did before. I don't remember the story, but yeah, it was back in like the early 70s, and I guess he had attorneys and got off of the charges.
Mm.
So he didn't have a criminal record, but he had been arrested, yeah.
So he was arrested while you were with him.
Yeah.
How was he arrested? How did that come about?
You know, I don't remember a lot of the details, but I do remember the child was very, very, very young. And I'd like 7 or 8 years old. And I was probably 13 or 14. And, you know, as I grew older, I realized that his attention was with me was just, you know, starting to get less involved. Because, you know, he had, again, a serious problem in pedophilia. Mm-hmm. So, but he was arrested, and I actually ended up going to court and testifying for him.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, I mean, you know, here's this man who's now coaching me and grooming me to protect his very sick lifestyle, and I did it. He manipulated me into doing it, and I thought I was doing the right thing. So,
well, but,
you know,
but that's not so unusual. You're 13 or 14 at the time. You had a horrible experience with your own father. At least this guy wasn't, I mean, he was giving you drugs, that was dangerous, but he wasn't beating you. He wasn't throwing you out of the house. He was allowing you in.
Right.
So for a 13-year-old who had such a bad experience, that's not unusual. That's
it's not.
Yeah.
That
it's
would be
not.
Like a welcoming environment, you know?
Compared to
well,
what
it
had.
Was. Yeah. It was, comparatively, it was, yeah.
Comparatively, but you had nothing good to compare it to, really.
Exactly.
Other than friends when you were growing up. What happened to this guy?
So, you know, I don't know where he is today, but he was found guilty, and he was banned from being around any minors that were under 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I still continued a relationship with him for a little while, very discreetly, but I just, you know, I became too old. Once I hit 16, you know, that was it for him.
So he was not put in jail?
I think he did a little bit of jail time, but he got off. Because, again, the first charges that he had gotten dropped for some reason, for I guess over a technicality or something like that.
So this
like
was
that.
Really a first offense?
It really was.
Huh.
So.
Well, speaking of, though, what is your record like today? I mean, did most of this, what I would hope, would be on a juvie record and not affect you today,
yeah.
And, you know, you're not having to carry all of that around with you, you know?
Yeah, I don't. I did have a couple little minor things that were expunged, and, you know, again, the book project has been a really great inspiration for a lot of people that are involved in the criminal justice system to be very supportive. I had a couple small minor things on my record, which are now have been removed, so I'm clean.
Yeah, except if you were ever to apply for a job again, all those things are out there because you have this book that's online.
Yes. It's and you know what? It's really scary for me because I'm a professional, and that's another thing that I talk about when I go to these shelters and I talk to these kids. And, you know, I mean, I was a ghetto child. I was a hood rat. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, a wannabe gangbanger. I mean, I never robbed or beat people, but, you know, that was the image that I wanted to portray. Mm-hmm. And so I talk about it because, you know, now, and, you know, and I'm a man that has a few tattoos and stuff like that, but, you know, at the end of the day, I step up, I suit up, and I show up for work, and I'm professional, mm-hmm. and I follow protocol. And I think that's something that I really want to get across to a lot of these kids that are trying to get off the streets, because this is what we're going to need to do if we want to survive in America. We need to step up to the plate, and we need to be responsible. We need to step up to protocol when we need to do that. We need to talk properly. We need to not talk ghetto when we're trying to get a job. I mean, you know, these are the things that I'm trying to do. And I had to relearn speech because, you know, I was a hood rat. I talked crazily. And so... You know, these are just some of the things that I talk about when I'm inspiring these kids, and that's really why I wrote this book, is so I could really talk to the kids. I mean, I think it's a fascinating story for a lot of other people,
mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's just something that, it's a qualification for the children who are now caught up in the system and don't know how to get out.
Hmm. At some point, you did leave the Seattle area. You moved to California.
I did. I went to San Francisco.
How old were you when you did that?
I think I was 18 or 19, probably just turned 19.
Okay, so you were no longer a minor at the time. You stayed right around where your parents were. Did you have more interaction with your own family during your teen years?
Not much. Once I got off the streets when I was about 20 or 21, I did start having conversations with my brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother, and I kept in contact with my mom. I never made peace with my father.
No, in fact, you tell a story in your book about your mother calling you at one point where he's very sick, and you decide to go and see him with her, mostly because you want to make sure that his diagnosis is lung cancer and that he's going to die.
And that was really it. And, you know, and... For somebody who is a spiritual being and who's on a spiritual journey, I really wanted to document that experience because I was very bitter, I was very angry, and that bitterness and anger only hurt me. It didn't do anything for him. And so basically what that journey talked about and what it unfolds is that my father was somebody who was in a lot of pain and who deserved forgiveness, and he deserved my forgiveness, and he deserved for me to step up to the plate. So as I evolved in that situation, I began to fly up there to take care of him. And even though we hadn't made amends, and even though we hadn't had that aha moment, I went up to take care of him, and I forgave him because I wanted him to die in peace. And I wanted to live in peace. So, you know, I talk about it in the book, and it was a very profound moment where he looked up at me after realizing everything that I had been doing for him, and after I had flown up every weekend to spend time with him and my mother. He just looked at me and he smiled. And I looked back at him and I put my hand on him, and it was the most powerful moment in my life, the most powerful experience in my life. There was no hug. There was no, "I'm so sorry, son, I love you."
Mm-hmm.
It was just this one brief moment of a spiritual forgiveness that changed my life. And I talk about that because, you know, I'm somebody who carried a lot of anger and a lot of resentments for my life, and they really almost killed me.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Do you think he was remorseful? Do you think he regretted how he lived his life?
I don't know. All I know is that moment of forgiveness, whatever it was, whatever came into that room, completely wiped away everything. So even if he wasn't, it didn't matter to me. My life is my life, and I wouldn't change a thing at this point,
mm-hmm.
because I wouldn't be who I am today.
Right.
But I forgave him, so all that doesn't matter.
Was that necessary for you to do, do you think? And is it necessary really for any homeless kid to eventually do in order to go on with their life and say, you know, what happened, and I'm a good person, and I did what I needed to do in order to go on with my life now and help other people and be a good person.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, we all have friends that hold on to little stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you hear it, you know, and you get into this little gossip fest with your friends, and they're talking about so-and-so and who they don't like or whatever. And it's like, you know, this kind of goes along with that, too. I try to not participate in that stuff. Of course, I do. I'm not perfect. But, you know, I really try to promote, you know, love and forgiveness, because it's really crucial for our happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're not going to have really great experiences holding on to anger and resentment, you know. And I know a lot of people that do the 12-step stuff, and I don't represent 12-step programs.
Right.
But I have participated sometimes. That's something that they talk about, too. Mm-hmm. And that's not just something that was designed by 12-step programs. Those are all spiritual principles that have been around since the earth was created. I mean, those are just spiritual law that are as prevalent as the laws of gravity. You know, they're just basic laws that are in place, and they're present, and they work, you know.
We're talking to Justin Reed Early. His book is Street Child. It's available on Kindle. It's available on Amazon.com. Justin, stick with us. We have one more segment of our show to go. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the prostitute, Patty Fink, and we'll be back with more right after this.
If it's time to get rid of your old gas guzzler, the KNON Vehicle Donation Program can help. There is still a market for those old vehicles, and if you donate it, you are helping to support the quality programming here on KNON. Just call 877-KNON-AUTO or go online to KNON.org. We'll take care of everything from pickup to tax paperwork. That's 877-KNON-AUTO.
This is William. I watch Lambda Weekly on YouTube.com, recorded live from KNON Studios.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink, and our guest is Justin Reed Early. His book is Street Child. Patty, you had a...
Yeah, I have a quick question. I've always kind of wondered this, because, you know, we are how we're raised, really, for a long time in our lives, mm-hmm. until we really find who we are and examine how we want to live our lives. And as a kid of 10 or 12 or 14 or whatever, you were homeless, and you didn't have a lot of possessions, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel? What is your relationship today with possessions?
Possessions. Well, I can definitely. I love shiny things. I gotta tell you, I do. I love shiny things. You know, I like clothing. I like, you know, and I have to be really careful because, you know, I'm somebody who can use shopping, and, you know, I mean, it's my retail therapy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I have to be careful. But, you know, what's nice is that at my age is that I have things now that I've had for many, many years, which wasn't the case when I was living on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Were you able today now, after, you know, like renewing your relationship with your mother and your brothers and others, are you today in possession of, like, family photos and some of the things you had as a child?
Yes. Yes.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but your photos are all either from when you're younger than 10, when you were with your family, or then over 20. You have no real record of your teen years at all, do you?
Right.
Yeah.
Because you have no yearbooks. You have no,
yeah, none of that.
No, we didn't have cell phones then, I assume.
Exactly. Since
we're both 29.
Yeah.
But yeah, exactly.
Do you have trouble now getting rid of anything? In other words, you had stuff when you were a kid, but all of a sudden you really had nothing through your teen years. All of a sudden, after graduating, getting your GED, going to college, and then becoming a real person, you know, a real healthy person who could start living a fairly normal life, do you now have trouble with certain things that other people don't? Like getting rid of anything because, oh, no, I couldn't have for so long, now I want to keep that.
Well, didn't you see my episode of Hoarders? No, I'm kidding.
Right, exactly.
No. You know what? I have to purge stuff. I mean, just stuff that doesn't serve me in my life. Mm-hmm. I do it emotionally, mentally. I do it physically. I do it with possessions. If there's something that doesn't serve me, I have to get rid of it. I can't just have it sitting around. Or I try to donate it or give it away. A lot of my old clothes I'll donate to the shelter. You know, that's something that I encourage everyone to do. They're always in need of clothes and in the colder cities, blankets. You know, and socks and underwear and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I try to keep my life pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
But I love nice stuff. You know, I save up and buy a new bed or, you know, whatever,
mm-hmm.
piece of furniture. car.
But that could also be a result of that, that I'm used to not having anything, so I have too much stuff now.
Yeah.
that could almost be. Yeah, yeah. But that need to really help other kids in that position, I guess, is... I mean, that's a good result of this, that you know, you recognize that there are people out there like this that need your help.
It is, but it's also been a scary, it's been a very risky thing for me to do. Again, I'm a professional. I work, you know, for corporations that are usually tend to be on the more conservative side. So this was a very, very big risk for me, and it's a very scary thing. You know, it's not something that I would promote in my office, but it's definitely something that I can't hide, because it is something I'm passionate about, and I will continue to go out there and I'll continue to share the story because it helps people.
Well, you know, one of the efforts that we are making here in North Texas, and I'm sure all over the country, is to talk to shelters, and certainly there aren't enough for LGBT youth, for sure. But, you know, there are a lot of shelters for, you know, victims of domestic violence and survivors of domestic violence and child abuse and all of those things. But one of the issues is, are they welcoming to LGBT-identified people? And a lot of them are not. And so it's an effort to say, when a person's in need, will you accept a trans person? Will you accept, you know, all of these? And so when working with them, a lot of them say, of course we do. Of course we will. We'll state so that they know.
Yeah.
And we'll include our names in literature so that people know that we're available to them. And they don't have to worry about discrimination or not being accepted or getting no opportunity to be there. I know that, you know, there were probably even less opportunities for LGBT kids out when you were on the street. But in talking with kids today, what would you say to shelters today that you've been around to about what kids really need when they're in that situation, especially LGBT kids? What do they really need?
What do they really need? They need everything. You know, I had a question. I did a lecture up in Fresno a few months back, and that was one of the questions. What is the one thing that you feel would really help get these kids off the street? And you know what? There's no one thing. It's everything. It's every service, every required thing that a child needs: love, empowerment, clothing, education. All these things are required. Treatment. It could be medicine for any, you know, mental or physical, you know, disorders that they may have, whatever it is. So it's everything. Everything is a brick in the wall. Like, what was the one thing that saved me? It was everything. It was all of those wonderful, loving, kind people who tried to save my life while I was on the streets. The outreach workers, the nonprofit heroes, soldiers. They're soldiers that have gone out and risked their lives every day in these very dangerous environments to help children and people that are living on the streets. And, you know, I just pay homage to them in my book, because they, if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be here. We've made a lot of progress for the LGBT community in shelters. There are a lot of LGBT specific shelters. Ali Forney in New York is amazing. I know that Dallas has, I'm not sure how they are with LGBT community, but they have the Promise House.
Promise House,
you know,
is wonderful.
Yeah, it looks awesome online.
Yeah.
And you know, there's definitely more more empowering environments. You know, I don't want tolerant environments. I want empowering environments that empower every child to do better and to be their best. Children are 100% of our future, and we need to invest in all of them as such, you know?
When you okay, let's go back to that street preacher. He's arrested. You testify for him. He's found guilty. Didn't the court system say, oh, you know what? Here's this kid. He's 14, 15 years old. He needs some help.
Right.
Yeah, especially after say, wait, this guy's going up the river or whatever for abusing kids.
What did they do with you afterwards? Did they just send you out of the courtroom?
Pretty much. You know, I was continually arrested as a child. I was I wasn't an adult yet, but, you know, one of my, and this is, you know, this is something that I have many people that I look up to that are including police officers and judges and probation officers, but there was one judge who was on the bench in Seattle who was a juvenile court judge who oversaw my custody, who was a predator who took advantage of me.
Jeez.
And created a relationship. Yeah, so he actually ended up being exposed by the Seattle, it was either the Seattle Times or one of the papers up there, and went to his judge's chambers and killed himself in the hallway.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah. Huh. It was a big thing up in Seattle. But,
so who,
everyone's not like that. But.
So who, no, of course not, but, you know, it's like, but that one person, how many lives did he ruin? You said that there were a number of street soldiers who helped you. Can you tell us about any of them that really were ones that turned your life around?
Well, there's one. There was an African-American woman who was my public defender when I was a child. I think I met her when I was about 12, and she began representing me. She was this amazing woman. Her name is Judy Hightower, and she represented me for several years while I was going through the juvenile justice system. I actually wanted her to be my foster mother, and but she was a single mom. She had two kids of her own, including a toddler, had just put herself through law school as a single mother. Amazing, amazing woman.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she was just somebody that I always looked up to. And it was funny because I had lost contact with her when she had gone off to do, you know, become a, you know, a lawyer for, you know, mm-hmm. mainstream. And several years later, I was arrested for just something minor. I don't remember what it was, probably a probation violation or something. And I look up to the court, and there was this judge, and it was her. She was my
wow.
judge.
Mm. Oh, wow. Did she recognize you?
Of course she did. She told the prosecutor, she's like, you know, there could be a conflict of interest. I used to represent him, blah, 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 blah. The prosecutor was like, oh, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, she looked at me and she said, Justin, whatever you're doing, it's not working.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And I remember her saying that to me. And I just remember because I loved her and I adored her and I wanted her to be my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I'm white and she's black, so it's just really funny, but...
Yeah.
You know, I just loved her and I adored her, and she looked at me and she gave me the max. And she was one of the first people I communicated with when I went to Walden House and I started going back to school and I went to college. And, you know, I wrote her a letter and I sent it to the Seattle courthouse. She wrote me back this wonderful, amazing, empowering card. And we became friends, and I became supportive of her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and just she's been very close, and she's been a mentor for me for many, many years.
And you're still in touch?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah. She's I participated. There's some nonprofit work that she's done, and she's asked me to participate with her, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, and likewise. So,
Do you think she gave you the max to, you know, do the proverbial three hots and a cot?
You know
a place
she did
to stay?
I asked her, because I wrote about this in the book, and I called her the B word. I was like, I can't believe she did that to me. Well, you know, years later, I said, you know, I just want to ask you a question. Why did you, you know, I mean, I know that, you know, you thought there might be a conflict of interest, but why did you give me the maximum?
Mm-hmm.
She goes, oh, honey, I did that so you could get off probation because you weren't compliant.
Mm-hmm.
You would have gone to jail every other day had I not done that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, I said, oh, you were helping me.
Oh, right.
Ah.
Right.
Well, yeah. Wise woman.
Yeah.
Yeah, very.
Huh. You know, and how many of you was she also dealing with? You know, how many others like you?
Exactly, and she does. She does a lot. And, you know, I really want... She's still on the bench, so I don't try to bother her with this kind of stuff because, you know, they have to keep a very, you know...
Sure.
They have to be very professional. But, you know, someday I want to maybe write an article on her or something and just talk about... Because she's got definitely one of the most unique perspectives of the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's really important that that they share their story. You know, there was a judge up in Fresno who convened a task force because, you know, we tend to criminalize victims. In America,
mm-hmm.
if you're shoplifting, well, you know what? You're shoplifting. So we're gonna arrest you. We're gonna put you in jail. And you know, we don't look at a lot of circumstances that are tied to that. And so he convened a task force that involved the probation office, law enforcement, other judges, and you know, what can we do to stop criminalizing these people who are participating in minor survival crimes? You know, we need to help them, and we need to get them off the streets, and we need to empower them into better lives. And that's one of the most amazing stories that I have to share about the response of my book. And that's what we want to do and replicate. I'm working with a gentleman now. His name's Rob Warnoff, and he's a consultant for the Human Rights Campaign, and they do trainings. And Patty, this goes back to what we were talking about, LGBT youth and programs, and they do these trainings to help mainstream agencies deal with the LGBT community properly and fairly and empoweringly. And so he's been working directly with me to kind of help prepare these trainings that we can also take out and utilize the book as a resource.
Mm. Well, that's fabulous because, you know, I'm sure there are some mainstream, you know, organizations that would love to help, but they don't know how to begin.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And, you know, that's a great way to fulfill their needs, too.
Yeah. Justin, you've reconciled with your mother, reconciled with your brothers.
I did.
Did you find that your mother was also severely abused at the time? Is that why she allowed you to be thrown out of the house?
Well, she was. And, you know, I don't want to give the book away, but I do want to honor my brothers. Both my brothers passed away back in the 90s.
Hmm.
And I was able to make peace with them before they passed. One brother had gotten involved in drugs as an IV drug user, mm-hmm. and was arrested for minor crimes and sent to prison where they were not allowed to have medication. And he passed away from AIDS complications in prison. And then a couple months later, my other brother passed away from brain cancer. So they mm-hmm. both passed. But, you know, I was able to make peace with them, which is a very warm, you know, I mean, I'm blessed to have that. But, yeah, my mother was abused, you know, her and my father, you know, in their later years. I think they sort of, I don't know if they ever communicated about what happened in our family, but they were able to sort of work it out, you know.
Hmm.
And after my father died, my mother was living alone up in north of Seattle. They moved up north of Seattle. And I got a phone call, and she's like, I don't know what to do. I can't live alone anymore. I'm just getting too old. I can't see. I can't drive. And I ended up going up to Seattle, packing up her house, help her sell it. I said, well, why don't you come stay with me for a few months while we figure out where we're going to put you? You know? Mm-hmm. And so she started staying with me, and she's still with me to this day, you know?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she's my biggest fan, my best supporter. She's purchased books for kids that are in shelter. She's been very supportive of this project. It's a very painful project for her, but she's been very supportive of it. You know, she doesn't clean my room or do my laundry. Just, you know, I have a problem with that. But, you know, she's very loving and kind. And
you've reconciled her part in this.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay, good.
Wait, I'm curious now, what about your aunt? Are you
my aunt is amazing. Absolutely. I love her to death. She lives up in Whidbey Island, up in Washington State. She is she's a soldier in her own right. She's just one of the most loving people that I have in my life. And her kids, my cousins, I'm pretty close with all of them. And I actually just talked to one last night. They've all been very, very supportive of the book project, and they're just amazing. They're like my brother and sisters. There's one male and two female cousins. And then I have other cousins from my mother's side who are up in Bellingham, Washington, who've been very amazing, too. I'm very lucky.
Your aunt was there, like, that first day, I guess, and, you know, trying to step in, and that's
great. She was at the hospital when I was born. I mean, like, she was there from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. So, you know.
Well, Justin, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. You guys are awesome.
Yeah, enjoyed having you. You know, this is a topic that we haven't discussed a whole lot. In writing for the newspaper, I've addressed some of these issues, but on the air, I can't think of another time that where we've discussed homelessness quite this way.
I just want to want to run off a couple statistics. You know, every year it's estimated that 1.6 to 2 million children experience homelessness in America at any given time. That's more than the population of Dallas, which is about 1.2-something million.
Right.
You know, that's a lot of kids that are on the streets that don't have resources to take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to take a look at that. We need to get involved, and we need to change how we view these issues.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We do. The book is Street Child. Justin Reed Early is the author. You can find it on Kindle. You can find it on Amazon.com.
Yes.
Justin, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, David. Thanks, Patty. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks. Have a good day.
And I did,
you too.
I wanted to point out, just before we go off the air, that LaRon and I had a bet at the beginning of the year. And that was that Illinois would pass same-sex marriage before Rhode Island. We both lost because Delaware passed both
right.
of them. But Rhode Island did pass same-sex marriage, and Illinois' legislature closed their session without passing it.
Yep.
What were they thinking? I bet on them.
You're gonna choose wiser.
I'm supposed to be right. And this afternoon, the reason Laurent isn't here, and your wife is also,
yep.
They're in a zombie walk.
It's the Run for Your Lives. It's a 5K run where the runners have lives around their belts, and they can be yanked, and their obstacles are zombies. And Erin paid $35 to be a stumbler. But she's going as a lesbian activist zombie. So she left the house with a t-shirt that said, "Love is everywhere." And she has all these great buttons, you know, and so it's going to be really fun. And I found one for her that has the red circle with the line through it for death penalty. I think it'll be really fun. She's going to wear that one, too.
So. So she'll come home covered in blood?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the way I like seeing her best.
I told her she should be a nerd zombie where they say, you know, cerebral cortex. But, you know, that didn't fly.
Where is this taking place?
Over in Forney, I think.
It's in Forney. Yeah. And she is... no, that's okay. You're on the air. Just, you know, get into the camera. Our person who was on after us on the morning show, come join us. That's it for us on Lambda Weekly today. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the prostitute Patty Fink. And and we'll be back with more. Who's our guest next week? Yeah, I don't remember either, but I know we have one. We'll be back next week with more.